I'm Rob Lane, and apparently a kind of old-fashioned guy, although I have to say I don't think of myself that way, so I have to figure out a way to shed that. But just to turn that story around, I think the point of that exercise that we did with the mayor was that actually different tools, both high-tech and low-tech, are appropriate at different stages of the process and depending on what you're doing. And I happen to be partial to using physical models because I'm an architect, but all tools at all times, depending on where you are, is the rule. Clearly, there's a tremendous amount of potential brewing for the uses of new media, and I say brewing because as a practitioner in the region, I think there's actually been surprisingly little penetration in the way planning is actually practiced. We know that there is a broad range of technologies that go all the way from more complicated visualization software, such as UrbanSim and CommunityViz and Index, that presumably give stakeholders the ability to move things around quickly and understand what their implications are. The other end of the spectrum, there are various kinds of electronic media that are now widely used by the general public, everything from communication to gaming to navigation. And in between these two, there are a variety of instruments that were really developed for planning professionals but have merged into the public realm. And this, of course, includes graphic information systems, GIS, the use of Google Maps, Google Earth, and SketchUp now in terms of three dimensions. There are a broad range of things going on. Some of them are very exotic and technology-based, such as Amsterdam Real Time. These are just a few smattering of representative projects, a kind of art project, really, that use GPS to track the movements of Amsterdam residents over a period of time, or the Sensible City work at MIT, where they're using cell phone traffic to model what happens during events in cities. GIS is widely used now for interactive mapping, things such as Common Census, which enables people to really remap the world based on a different set of parameters, the importance of these places to them, or green maps, developing interactive maps for the environment. There's locative software, things like Tagzania and Yellow Arrow, other forms of narrative media where you put these tags up and then you can take the barcode, use your cell phone to retrieve the story that someone wrote about that particular place. And, of course, there's an exploding world of cell phone applications such as and the sites that support them, such as See, Click, Fix, and this project, which was about locating, giving people the tools to locate bike racks in their own neighborhoods. Again, I say that there's a lot brewing because I think the implications of how these new technologies are going to affect planning is really not clear yet. They're both opportunities and, I think, issues, and we're going to try to explore some of those this morning. And now a kind of a brief anecdote about the format of this event, because we, which I think is actually telling about a variety of things, we, the panelists, had several discussions about, well, isn't this the opportunity to demonstrate new media being used in various ways, since that's what this is about. And the sort of in-house discussion came down on the side of, well, this isn't really that kind of crowd, necessarily. Which I thought was really interesting. In fact, I'm curious, how many people, you know, either have laptops that they're going to be actively using during the session, Twittering people and so on? Okay, so there are a handful, but this is not a tech concert, a conference where everyone in the room is sort of doing this. And we discussed about whether or not to have a sort of back-channel, a so-called back-channel media where actually you can, the moderator can track the temperature in the room and what people are interested in as we go along. So that was interesting that we decided this was not that kind of crowd necessarily. And were we trying to do it just for the sake of doing it, or was it actually going to add any value? And we decided at this event it wasn't actually clear that new media was going to add any value. And so we're not doing it. And, of course, as soon as I walked into the room, this is not the space. As any planner would appreciate, you physically would not set this place up if you were trying to do that. Our moderator saw this immediately and said, well, the way to get through this is I'm going to do the Oprah Winfrey, and I'm not going to stand up here and moderate. I'm going to walk through the crowd with a mic, which I totally encourage. But we did set up a different format where there are going to be a series of questions that the panelists will give very brief responses to. We don't have a lot of PowerPoint presentations to give here. And then we'll invite you to ask questions or respond to those as well. So it's meant to be as interactive as it can, given this somewhat conservative setting. So briefly to our introductions, our panelists are Michael Keating, who is in charge of business development at TOP, which is a nonprofit that is exploring all of these issues, the Open Planning Project. His focus is on accessible tools that enable participation, particularly on transportation planning these days. He's an entrepreneur and designer with a focus on environmental issues. Barbara Faga, Executive Vice President at AECOM, is an urban planner, has been an urban planner for a large variety of large mixed-use projects. She's managed hundreds of public planning and design processes. Her experiences are gathered up in several books, including Designing Public Consensus, The Civic Theater of Community Participation. Damon Rich, urban designer for the City of Newark and the founder of the Center for Urban Pedagogy, which is a nonprofit that was really exploring the intersection, the ways in which the arts and other kinds of media could be used to support community-based planning and design in creative ways. And Ed Blakely, lastly, our moderator, honorary professor of public policy at the moment at the United States Center at the University of Sydney, the executive director of the office. He has been the executive director of the Office of Recovery and Development Administration for the Rebuilding of New Orleans, former dean at both USC and the Milano School here in New York, author of numerous articles and books, including Fortress America and Separate Societies, Poverty and Inequality in U.S. Cities. He has had numerous public service appointments, including an advisor to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And with that, I'm going to
get out of the way.
Get out of the way and prepare for answering questions.
Well, is this on now? Okay. I feel much better already. You know, being up there makes you feel like you're kind of in a fishbowl and everybody's going to come after you. But we're going to try to run this as an interactive. The last time... last time I did this, I said, I'm going to be Oprah. And they said, well, there's one thing wrong with that. Yeah, I'm shorter. They said maybe Morgan Freeman. So we'll try Morgan Freeman today.
By the way, Oprah will be here next Monday.
Next Monday? So I better not mess up. For lunch. Okay. I'll catch up. That's right. I'll still be in town. We actually did this panel, though, electronically. I was in Sydney, Australia, and we got together from various cities and so forth and arranged this. So if it's messed up, it's an electronic problem. You know, participation means, is that the right one to push? Am I pushing the right? Yeah. Why is nothing happening? Well, so much for electronics and new media. There we go. So participation, we're talking about engagement, people actually involved in making something. Give me the next one. Are we talking about involvement, that they have a stake in it? Because participation means a lot of things to a lot of people. And usually when we're talking about participation, we're talking past one another. I saw a sign coming here, I went through California, and they said, shouldn't voters vote on whether the public utilities companies, the private utilities companies should be taken over by the public? And I said, gee, that makes sense, but why does the public know any more than an elected representative? You know? Now, how's the public going to make a decision about who should run a utility? It's certainly, there are a lot of things I'd like the public to have a vote on, but I'm not sure when it comes to really technical matters, the public, no matter how much participation goes on. So the next one, co-optation. I mean, we certainly do this. We have a lot of meetings, you know, maximum feasible misunderstanding. These meetings, the government presents its proposal, its program, and so forth, and you're supposed to like it. And if you don't like it, your name doesn't get recorded. That's something we do in another country I live in. And a lot of young people are involved in this, but if you do the wrong thing, push it, they go away. They don't come back. So if you just try to co-opt people, they get it. And they just simply don't come back. They're not going to be bothered. All right, next one. And then there's collaboration. Now, who's the participant here? And what are they participating in? And if there's genuine collaboration, that means it's really a two-way street. And much of our public participation is really kind of a one-and-a-half-way street. The person with all the information is in the front, and the people who are supposed to say yes, no, or maybe are out in the audience, but they don't have enough information to really participate. And then there's consultation, where you certainly want a lot of input to any kind of public decision. And consultation now, when I lived here in New York, I thought the strap hangers, great consultation process, all this information, the strap hangers, they surveying you all the time, you're being consulted. But I never saw anything change. Maybe things do change, but you don't know whether it's through that process. And then giving people a real decision stake. You know, when it ends up, it's theirs. And I think your little models, Rob, I like those because you can move the things around. And when you see at the end, you can see you were involved in that decision. But most of us can't see that we're involved in the decision because the lead times are too long. Last one. And then the cultural bound participation. I now live in Australia, and I've had more appreciation, actually, for mixes of cultures than I did living here. Because we have an awful lot of new migrants, and when you bring them to a meeting in my neighborhood, they don't want to be there because they're afraid people like him are taking pictures. And where they come from, Tibet, this is not something good. There are other people who may be spying on them in other ways. Government is not viewed as a good thing. So, you know, how do you make participation work for all people, particularly with these new media ideas and new ways of communication? So I'm going to do what the last moderator did. I'm going to throw out a question and then have each of our panelists address it for a minute or two. And then I'm going to throw it out to you and let some of you address the same issue. In the first one, we're going to start at the kind of the real tough part of this process of the new participation. The new mass participation allows everyone to participate. Sarah Palin, my favorite person, was participating in the Tea Party Express meeting. I think it was yesterday or the day before. That meeting was organized by people who are not members of the Tea Party. They're an advertising company that made a lot of money on her presence. It just shows you how capturing an idea, you can actually hijack it. So it's possible to hijack participation with this new media, using the name, logo, etc., and change the meaning entirely. George L. Orwell was right about that. So, to our guys, start with Mike. Was this new, are there some dangers in using all this technology to really try to communicate with the masses?
I think that I go after that two ways. I think the first is that there's part of the root of the question, I think, is sort of how to, is that this stuff is a little bit inevitable, that all these technologies are out there, and we can't really go back to a time when if you're the planner or you're the official or you're the designer, you can kind of control the name, you can control the way the issue is framed, you can control how your project's being presented. So I think it's about, you have to get out there and get into it, and you have to understand how these things, whether it's, you know, social networks or other forms of participation that we're seeing now with the new communication medium, you have to participate in that, you have to understand it. Otherwise, I think someone might get ahead of you and understand it first. So I think there are risks, but you kind of have to dive in. I don't think you can really kind of wall yourself off from it.
Are there some kinds you shouldn't use? Or is it determined by the activity?
I think that people are going to use this stuff.
Even, no matter. So it's out of your control.
A little bit. Well, it can be in your control if you engage with it and you get familiar with it, you get comfortable with it, you learn the tools. But if you try not to use certain tools because you think, you know, something's going to get away from you, someone else will jump in and use it. And so I think you have to be engaged with it.
Barbara?
Boy, I've watched this, you know, over the years change so much, because when I started doing public process, the person presenting was in charge, the designer presented it, everybody listened, and they went away. Now it's gone viral where people are so upset about the least possible thing. We were talking a minute at the beginning of the discussion here, and you have to start early. Who was it that we were talking to who said, you have to start early, you have to listen?
It was Charles.
And that was so important because you do have to start early. You have to listen, and you have to be able to frame the discussion. And the one thing I've always been involved with projects. You know, I'm involved with designing projects, getting projects built, moving projects along. And if you can't get the project approved, probably the most, as a consultant, the best thing you want to hear from a developer is, oh, these people aren't going to stop me. And then, you know, you're going to make a lot of money. As the consultant, can you just do this first slide I have? I'm not sure what number it is. Okay. This is Wharf District Park in Boston. I don't know if you know the Big Dig. Well, you went too fast. the first one is, that's what designers consider to be design without public participation, and then this is the next one was designed with public participation. And what had happened there was the public just got so crazed over this project that had been in design for 35 years, and then we were the last designer who was actually going to design the project. We started using this in the public meetings after we had some trust and some capability with the public there, and it actually turned out well. But what I've learned to do is try to, as Michael is saying, use these tools to your own benefit, because after all, you're the designer. But those of you that know that do this on a regular basis know you've got to be on all the time, and you've got to be thinking about this, you know, from the time you leave the meeting, through the night, through your shower in the morning, all day until your next public meeting, because you have got to have control of the situation, but not look like you have control of the situation.
So, but Rob, don't you have to start way, way, way back before there's any control?
Well, I'd like to sort of address some. Well, she sort of trumped one question that I was going to raise, which was in terms of those issues with mass participation, is whether or not there are a lot of architects and designers and urban designers and planners who wonder if there's a kind of lowest...
Rob, you got to...
Oh, I'm sorry. If there's a kind of lowest common denominator problem with having... I think there's an issue mostly around capacity issues. I think that, as those of you who are involved in planning, there's only one thing worse than not asking people what they think, and that's asking people what they think and not responding. And I think the burden that I see as a planner is that there's this ability to garner all this new input, and it has raised everyone's expectations about the level at which they should be able to participate. And I see a tremendous expectations management challenge for the profession to sort of figure out how to describe problems to people, to sort of explain to them the ways in which they can participate and in a constructive way, and in a way where you're actually able to respond to all of the new input.
Okay. Now, Damien, I know you, in the city of Newark, you've got a lot of participation, right? And so a lot of people turn out, and I'm sure it happens in Newark, it's happened in Oakland, New Orleans, and so forth. Some people use the media to discredit the other people who are participating. You've heard that before? These people just came late. In New Orleans, they weren't here during the flood. So why can they participate? They're not as black as I am. So why should they participate? You know, they're rich. So why should they participate? And then running, you know, blogs and things like that, and discredit people who are genuine participants. The people who come to the meeting are discredited by some people who never even come to the meetings. Does that happen in Newark?
Well, I think along with some of your examples, one of the greatest dangers to my mind of the new tools of participation are reinforcing existing hierarchies of power,
yeah.
Meaning that these technological tools, of course, are not evenly distributed across people, and so oftentimes they, in fact, end up empowering those who already have more than others. I think the second aspect of what you're asking is that, and it's already been alluded to in some of the responses, There's at least two levels at which we have to talk about this. One is at the project level. We're trying to get the project done, maybe in a better way than it might otherwise happen. But there also has to be another level of participation and infrastructure built around that, which I would consider participation for the long haul or popular education for the long haul. I think about Miles Horton, who some of you might know, who was involved in the founding of the Highlander Center, that provided an educational role for a number of campaigns, whether it was labor campaigns or perhaps more famously with the Civil Rights Campaign. And they had a very principled position that they themselves at the Highlander Center were not organizers, but they were educators who saw themselves in a synergy with organizers. And I would certainly say that today all of us in planning and design have to be organizers at least a little bit, so I think it's important to keep that in mind.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very, very good point. So who wants to add something to this mass participation using these new instruments?
Laura Hansen, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and following up on what Damon just said, I just am curious about what is the status of the digital divide at the moment, given that cell phones have become so prevalent, and what does that mean for all of this?
Anybody?
No, one thing I've noticed is if doing big public meetings and you get a variety of people, and I'm, you know, I have children and I'm actually back in school with people that are much younger than I am, and they're very technology savvy. But when you do public meetings in, say, like the city of Miami Beach, where there's a vast amount of people who will show up to those meetings because they're retired and they have time, and you tell them that the information is online, you can access it on the internet, does anyone have any problem with that? They won't tell you they have problems with that. They don't want to look embarrassed like they don't know that technology. So while there is a strata of people who do understand the technology, there's a large group out there that don't, that won't admit it, and you have to find a way to get them the information too. So that's one thing I'm concentrating on, because it seems like it's the older people in some of my meetings who are actually making the decisions and showing up.
Is the meeting a good thing anymore? Can't you get a lot of information without having a meeting?
I am Jean-Louis Moussica. I'm an architect and urban designer. Do you realize that community planning is not about meetings? It's about whole weekends sitting down with people over whole days and again and working actually from white paper, but having done your homework before, you have some appropriate ideas to propose. But in the same time, you have to convince, you have to listen. Just you're treating the public as a client, as an architect. When you are designing something for a client, the least you can do is sit down with him and listen to him and explain what you're doing. And I think that it's obviously in the realm of urban design, the only way to do it is to have to go through a community planning, open community planning, and they cannot be hijacked. Why can't they be hijacked? It's because the hijackers are not going to sit down and work with you for whole weekends. They will just go, you know. And the people who are going to sit down and talk to you and listen to you and work with you during the whole Friday and Saturday and Sunday in that school somewhere on the site in a school where there's going to be some community planning process over several weekends. And these people who are going to sit down with you, they're not going to hijack anything. You have to trust them. And it's the only way to do a decent job as far as urban planning is to consider the open public as the client.
Yeah, I'd just like to just two things. One, your point in a moment, but just to go back to the digital divide. As somebody does a lot of work outside of New York City, I do a lot of work in the suburbs, I think that people talk about the digital divide being a kind of typically relating it to kind of socioeconomic things. There's definitely a geographic digital divide, and I find that in the suburbs, even the wealthier and presumably more sophisticated suburbs, there's been much less penetration of all of the sort of hip media applications as than you might imagine. The discussion that we had this morning about sort of apps and the development of new cell phone applications and so on, not only is that urban, it's almost New York centric in the immediate region. And so I think we kind of have to accept that to some extent or understand it in order to use the new media properly. And I just want to back up what you're saying. I think to some extent all of us agree with what you're saying. So I would say that to me one of the big challenges is how do you really build, and I think Damon alluded to this, a big part of this is, number one, whether or not there's civic infrastructure in place in the places where you're working anyway. I've never done a successful planning project where there wasn't already some civic infrastructure in place, a group of local people who are already interested in doing this and taking it forward. And how do you increase their capacity, their long-term capacity to manage the process themselves? And I think media could, I don't know that it is yet, but I think media can play a role, new social media can play a role in reinforcing that civic infrastructure and that community that is ultimately your client.
One more question.
Yeah, Pat Steinschneider from Dodds Ferry. We've been involved in a project that Rob's very familiar with, redoing the zoning, land use and everything in our community. And we've made some use of these things. We have things that show up on a very slow-moving website, and we have things on television. Our sister village, Hastings, has been doing a somewhat similar process. And a major difference, I think, between the way the two have been working, and Dobbs, I think we're going to be running into a problem soon. And that's the blog side of this is not the one that I think is the problem. It's the lack of maintaining a history of it. When you do those weekend-long sessions, they have to be recorded, they have to be available, and you have to be able to come back to them. What we're running into when you talk about hijack, we've gone through this process for maybe 5 years now. Hastings has all of their meetings accessible. You can go online and see what was actually said at such and such a meeting. I don't think in Dobbs we have that kind of a recall. And where I'm afraid we're going to get hijacked is by actually the people who are in the highest level of power who haven't necessarily been there every day and every meeting. In fact, many of the meetings they haven't participated in. And now we're getting to an end of something. And they don't have that reasoning, that understanding of how all the contributions that have been made by so many people. It's not evident. The blog is one side of it. The being able to record the stuff and have it accessible back to anyone who's interested in a future date, I think, is critical.
Betsy had a comment.
Yes, ma'am.
So, Betsy Machine, I'm on the Comprehensive Plan Committee in Hastings. So, but the side back to what Rob is saying is that we have a blog that almost no one participated in. The only time people really used the blog was when we were talking about some issues of circulation. And though we do have every one of our meetings is recorded, it doesn't mean that you can go back and find anything. And so I'm concerned we're at the final stages now where we're going to start presenting our plan to the community. And I'm very concerned about expectations management. People have been watching us on television, but only pieces of it. And I'm concerned of what happens with... I'm disappointed there wasn't more participation, not necessarily in blogs, but... people came in and out so infrequently and think that because they participated a little bit, therefore their idea is what was going to be ratified. And we're going to have a lot of hijacking now because of it. So I don't think it's...
I know there's some good questions are coming out of you, but like the Oprah show, you know, we've got a commercial and then we have to move on. So there's our commercial right there. The next question, though, is really very much related to this, and I think some of you had your hands up. We'll jump in here. Can we fundamentally change people's ideas, a community, and so forth, using this new media? That is, let's say, I'm trying to give an extreme example here, using your Hastings and so forth. You've got a inequality in the community. You know, the Hispanics haven't really been represented in this process, but you really want to get them in. Can you use this new media as a vehicle to get people who are underrepresented, for example, get their ideas really accepted as part of the process? That's a fundamental shift, because in the past they weren't there. They weren't really engaged. They weren't involved. But for equality purposes or equity purposes, you really want to get them engaged. Can we use this new media as a vehicle to get a fundamental transformation in what goes on in the community? We'll start with you, Damien.
Sure. I mean, I wonder, Ed, when you were showing some of your introductory slides, a lot of them reminded me of an article that I'm sure many people in this room are familiar with this, which is Sherry Arnstein's A Ladder of Citizen Participation from 1969.
They wouldn't publish that in JAPA now because there weren't any numbers or equations, but it's one of the best articles ever written.
Indeed, and what I think is so important about that is, you know, I look back to the people who worked on participation and planning before I was born, and even though, of course, it's not remembered this way, it was actually the Urban Renewal Law, Title I of 1949, that for the first time established the legal right of American residents to participate in the planning of the places that they live. And even though, of course, that formal right was not necessarily realized immediately, or perhaps not even yet, I think that really set us up in terms of now, 6 years later, to not just think about that right as participate or not, but really about the quality of that participation and the impact of that participation. And so one of the things that I think is enduringly useful about Arnstein's hierarchy, and it is indeed a hierarchy, very strictly ordered. If people don't know it, it starts with manipulation at the bottom, goes through therapy, through informing, up to placation, and then finally some forms of actual citizen control. I think that we need to be really clear about what type of participation are we really aiming at for a particular project. Because as we all know, as you were saying, Ed, due to technical requirements or even political imperatives, not the highest level of participation is feasible in every area. And of course, that raises all kinds of ethical questions of how we handle ourselves, those of us who are designing these processes. But I think that having that clarity that these different kinds of participation aren't just fungible and they're not just alternatives, but actually that there is a hierarchy, and the clearer that we can be about that and the clearer that we can have our constituents be, I think the more productive processes we'll have.
Good.
Michael, do you want to?
Mike?
Sure. I actually brought a slide on this if people want to put it up, but I think a lot of this technology kind of does change the way that we participate, and it can kind of fundamentally change the process. This is just a quick representation of kind of a typical planning process with three meetings and people showing up and looking at the documents and making comments. And if you hit the next key on it, we think of this sort of in terms of three dimensions. And so you guys are familiar with the idea of wikis and blogs and like ways that people can get access to your planning documents and make comments and participate even if they can't show up at the meeting. And I think that to a certain extent it expands participation and makes things more accessible. There is a digital divide question there, but there's value, I think, in some of these kind of basic technologies. And then if you advance it one more time, we think there's a second dimension, which is all this social media. Then we're talking about sort of, you know, is this going to get hijacked and is someone going to sort of Twitter our issue to death? But what we see happening is people are using these tools to engage their friends and their colleagues on the issue. And I thought, Ed, your point about sort of decision stake, I think one of the best ways to get people to feel like they have a decision stake is if their friend emails or Twitters or just talks to them and says, hey, you know, this is an issue for us. You should care about this. And so we see that happening on this sort of second dimension of technology participation. And then the last one is this gets a little more interesting. And this is where I think kind of participation can change. If we're making data available to people, and some of the conversations in the plenary talked about this, and if we're making software available to people, in 1939, it took the Regional Plan Association to make a photo montage to show the impact of a bridge in Lower Manhattan. It took experts and you know, sophisticated skills. And now RPA's executive director's daughter could do this with Photoshop. And so that's different participation. And you know, participation, I think we often think of you know, comments at a public meeting or an email. Participation now can mean download the GIS data, throw it into SketchUp, extrude your own development, and show the neighborhood what you think the project could look like. And that's a form of participation that we see is possible with these new tools.
Yeah, and we use some of that at the Presidio in San Francisco and have people participate in that way and actually put their own drawings in and things like this. When people do that much work, they're really angry if it doesn't end up their way. And in New Orleans, I experienced people in deep denial about environmental consequences. You know, I want to live here, or I want to do this here, or I want to do that there. And my house wasn't raised before. Why does it have to be raised now? You know, that you can, you know, you can use this media in a sense to defeat reasoning, you know, or logic or science or whatever. So, comments from the audience, and I'll come back.
How does this affect cost? If I have a budget for a project and all of a sudden I'm not engaging 20 people as stakeholders but 200 people, can you explain how that would work?
Yeah, or 20,000. Here, 9/11, the meeting we held, Rob, was 6,000, but we engaged with 40, 50,000 people. We had to take all that input in. So,
it wasn't
cheap.
Expensive. I mean, I think...
You've been on once before, so you get the participation around.
I want to respond to her question, though, all right. Just briefly, which is that basically what we're talking about, and I had a slide somewhere that I don't want to bother to go to that was considerably messier, because I think that what all of us, those of us who do a lot of this community-based planning would say is that it's that the messier the better in some ways. In other words, the kind of the basic model, unfortunately... The more iterative it can be, and the less it's about a sort of a very defined scope of work and a very defined timeline, the more successful we all believe it could be. And you're right that the kind of industry is set up in such a way that it's too expensive to constantly be looping back. And I just think that there's a kind of a real cost issue here about... whether or not what's more expensive, having to go back, having to do over and over again a linear process, or upfronting the cost of what may be more expensive, but ultimately something that has a longer life, that there's ultimately an economy there. It's just not built into the fee structure of the industry.
Barbara? How many of you are using Turning Point? Anybody using that? You're not? There's a slide. My slide person's gone. Okay, can you put that one up? You're remote now. This is the best way I've found to record information, because I know we've all been caught in those planning loops. Can you go back one? Okay. No, not that one. That one. Okay. So we get caught in these planning loops, and you keep making the same decisions over and over again. And what I've learned is you have to come out of a meeting with a decision made. And the best way to record it, I've found, is using this software package, and it's not that expensive. And Turning Point. And what you get, I have a slide in here, which I'll show you in a minute. It's like a little, it looks like a garage door opener, and you press buttons. You've seen this? And it records automatically, easily. This is fabulous. Because what you can do, I walked into a meeting in Sarasota, Florida. People are all upset. They've been fighting a zoning war for 3 years, really mad. And it's a weekend charrette. And I wanted to see, I'm from out of town, I wanted to see what the mood was of the community. So I start out with, you know, the general slides you start out with, and then you do this, are you here with an open mind? Okay, now you can hit it. So you see... Okay, that tells you a lot right away. And what this does is fabulous, because you always get the three or four people who hate everything stand up and say, I speak for the community, but no one else is talking. So you don't know who's speaking really for the community. But what you can do with this, and there's a few slides later on, I don't know if you can get to them easily, where you can say, what is your priority? And they record it. It's recorded. Let's see. The numbers are on these slides. This is what it looks like. You press the button. You tell them it's not a power door opener or TV remote, and to leave it when they leave. But
Keep going. There's a couple in here that show this is the open mind one. Then there's, see, all right, so what is your opinion for the site? Very appropriate, not appropriate, whatever is appropriate. Okay, hit it. And as soon as they record it, it comes up like that. Then, when you go to city council later, and they're the same three people who hate everything are there saying, well, we didn't like this, no one liked it. You come back, you have these all printed out, you can show them. City council says, well, but that's what the 200 people there agreed to. So you can put whatever questions you want in there. Now, it is tough to use because you have to know how to put the questions together. And I've had cities after I've left buy the software, do it themselves, but they don't know how to ask the questions. And sometimes if you don't ask the questions right, you're not getting the answers you want. So I use the, what's your first priority, second priority, third priority? You know, you sort of leave yourself enough room in here to get the answers that you want. But it's fabulous.
Over and over. I got, they were the wrong people to ask.
Yeah.
Over and over. They're the wrong people to ask. People who lost it. Wrong people to ask. That's what
we use there. Hi. I'm Dan Latore with Project for Public Spaces, and I'm actually new there doing some digital media for them. And I guess I just want to continue with what Rob was talking about, how the costs are affected. I would say that you have to also think about people. It's not just about the tools. So there's mentions about the blogs and the wikis and whatnot, and you get buried in information. But a lot of the organizations that I've observed have very traditional sort of advertising or broadcast mentality relations to media. And you may need to retrain your marketing or communications people to be facilitating and being the community managers in these efforts. And so there's a sort of a role shift that needs to happen, because an organization that was set up for doing broadcast media or having that type of mentality isn't going to really work that well for highly segmentable media like this. The other thing is, your question before, Edward, was about will meetings change? And I think the one thing that we can get to is with mobile technology, you can get out of these rooms like this and actually go to the actual context and the site that is being talked about and have experiences or meetings on site, so that context is there, which really, I think, breaks down a lot of the single issue argumentation that happens when people are removed and abstracted in a building or space far away. And to that, about the digital divide, I kind of think that's sort of a there's sort of a cop out there. So I've been talking to some different groups, and one was like Uprose, a primarily Latino neighborhood group here in New York, and they said, we all have cell phones. How come all you white people think we don't have technology? We're on all these, we're on Twitter, we're on all these other things, MySpace, Facebook. You know, come and find us where we are and reach out to us, but we have the tech, don't think that we don't. We want to be doing these things, but no one's really asking us, or that isn't being presented. So there's certain assumptions that I think need to be updated.
I think the point about the importance of building internal capacity for these things is critical. I think if there's one way you want to blow your budget, hire a specialized consultant to do your civic engagement. I think it'll be much less effective and far more expensive.
Yeah, and I think it's important. Something you said earlier, Damon, though, I think it's important. Don't come to the people when you need a decision. Be there all the time. So then people trust you and they trust the process. But if you only come for the decision, then people's antenna are up. And I think that's part of the problem. This lady in the back.
Hi, just to say something positive about new media and outreach. You know, I'm from Connie Fishman from Hudson River Park, and we had decades of outreach and hundreds of hours of meetings. And the one thing that was missing, I would say, in the New York context of how these things get organized is the divide was really generational. The people who came to meetings are older, they have time, they don't have young families, they're not in school, and the bias in the planning in what should happen in the park was all towards things that people over the age of 55 or 60 might want to do if you built them a nice park. What was missing from that that you can get, especially with the social media, is what are the million people going to actually do there when they show up who are 18, 6, 25, you know, interested in other kinds of activities? And the one thing about outreach in general and these kinds of large planning projects is you're dealing with people when you have your meeting who care the most. But that doesn't mean you're dealing with the people who are actually going to use your resource the most. And you really have to count the people who aren't there, seem like they don't care, may not even know about you, because I think those are probably 80% of the people you're going to find in your project when you're done.
Excellent.
My name is Wiley Norville from Transportation Alternatives, and this seems like a brilliant way to go about things if we were starting from scratch, but I think of a lot of the projects that we work on where we have to graft something like this onto an existing process of community boards where we are talking about an older generation, a very entrenched process that already exists, and we send people who are 18 and 25 and 30 and have young families to these meetings. And really the only thing we can tell them is to articulate a yes or a no or a very unsophisticated position. And I'm wondering how we can take this and apply it to a really entrenched, you know, policy discussion that takes place at the community level in a city like New York that we don't really have the power to change or overturn or reinvent.
He's raising a good point. I live in Sydney, Australia now, and the Australian dream is the American dream, the half-acre lot and single-family house, and no one should ever do that. There should never be anything over two stories, and we're going to have another couple million people. And I say, well, there are two ways to solve that problem. Tell your kids to quit, and you die, and we've got the problem solved. No one wants those alternatives, but they're against everything. So how do you deal with the fact that the people, the real people who should be there, are 18, 19, 20, who say they'd like to live in a duplex or a triplex or a fourplex, but they're not at those meetings? How do you get them to participate? How do you? Because we're not designing for people my age. You know, my last day birthday began with a 7. And I asked my daughters, do I look over 7? They said, no, but you used to.
Well, in Newark, we've been doing a lot of planning work along our riverfront. And I think one way to characterize what a lot of people have been saying is simply appropriate technology, right? That all these things are tools. It's great to toss around different softwares that we can use, including democracy by the numbers, although I think that always raises this risk of losing what's most critical here, which I think is the process of deliberation. But, for example, we wanted to reach a lot of people in downtown Newark for a series of free public boat tours on the Passaic River. Mm-hmm. Most folks who live in Newark have never seen their city from a boat. And so even though we had an email list of about 1,500 people who were the diehard public meeting folks, what we found most appropriate in terms of technology was a postcard designed by someone who usually designs cards advertising club nights. I have a couple of them if you want to pass it around. And simply to be able to produce a palm card like this and leave it at the patty shop, at the T-shirt store, where you can find 7 other cards, advertising in a similar visual language, but this time it happens to be a planning project, was one way we tried to do that.
Yeah, and I think it's really good to think of all forms of media to meet people. We forget people running for public office know how to do this. And I saw the most brilliant thing that a pastor is doing in Australia. He's holding church in the bars. Because those are the people who need to be saved. So we got to think about that ourselves when you have these public meetings and so forth. Now, the pub is a sacred place in Australia. So having a meeting in the pub is better than having a meeting in the civic center. Because everybody's going to be at the pub. You have to know your culture. Where would the Vietnamese people in your neighborhood meet? Or in Flushing, where would you meet? Would you go to the Chinese Community Center, or would you go to the Ming Club? Because a lot of these meetings are held in spaces that the people who want to communicate don't usually come to. So we got to think about the venue as well as everything else.
Could I just jump in with a response to that? The term appropriate technology is pretty kind of an interesting expression that I'm most familiar with as from kind of actually the sort of international development world where people introduced a bunch of technologies overseas that failed and were embarrassing. And I think it's kind of a defensive expression. And I really liked hearing what Dan and the woman from Hudson River Park had to say about being a little more optimistic about this. And you have to plan for a digital divide that is still there. But if you come in with this sort of fear of doing the wrong thing with technology, you're never going to get the best out of it. So I think you want to give people the opportunity, whether it's Latinos who are on Twitter, or whether it's, you know, 20-something young families who, you know, maybe have the time late at night to, you know, do their own analysis and give you sort of an articulated opinion instead of a yes or no. And so just to counterbalance the kind of the sort of appropriate technology, sort of safe strategy, I think you also want to make sure that you're going to people where they are. And the easiest way to do that, frankly, isn't trying to have a public meeting in every different kind of ethnic neighborhood or age group neighborhood that you're in, but it's to get online, figure out what people are reading, what they're tweeting about, where they're, you know, communicating with each other, and be present there.
Well, I think you've exactly summarized, you know, the notion of appropriate technology rather than as something defensive. I simply see it as a call for self-consciously thinking through your media strategy. Mm-hmm. I've been to Governor's Island, I went to a focus group where they were saying, we send out all these emails, we Twitter, but no one comes. And, you know, and I think that that's clearly, you know, this techno-optimism that should be condemned. But I don't think that thinking about appropriate technology says that you're not optimistic and you're not experimental and innovative and inventive. I think it simply means that you have a multi-pronged strategy. You don't expect everyone to be tuning into a certain bandwidth.
You make the comment that's, I believe other people have made it too. It's a process. And especially as a consultant, when you come in and people, your client says, you have three meetings. You can't do anything in three meetings. It's a process. You have to build trust. People have to come. They have to talk to each other, know that you're going to learn something when you come. I often say, thank you for coming. We're going to decide on the facts here, that you can't come with your own facts. We have to all decide what the baseline facts are, because people will come in and they know exactly everything they're going to decide, and they don't change their mind in the first meeting. I've often seen that. No one changes their mind in a public meeting. It's a process where you have to bring people along and educate them and figure out where people are at the end of the meeting and at the beginning of the meeting, and start it out. It's almost a storyline. And that's what's important, is engaging everybody and seeing the process in there with the education and the trust, mm-hmm. bottom line.
So what are some of the ideal tenets I want to get from you guys, as well as from them, on good public process? I heard one, use multiple media, don't use just one. It is a process, it's not three meetings. What are some of the others?
I'm Gary Toth from the Project for Public Spaces, and before I worked at PPS, I spent 34 years at the New Jersey Department of Transportation trying to figure out how to engage our public in the things. And I was going to make a comment, but in reaction to your question, I'll sort of turn it into a thing. The biggest tenet of successful public involvement is being willing to spend the time and the money up front to build the trust in order to get a number of people engaged. And Rob alluded to that when he talked about the linear process, and everybody wants to follow a linear process, yet they do things over and over again. One of the most successful visioning plans that I've ever seen was Maine DOT, and they spent almost a year and almost $500,000 before they even discussed solutions with their community. The problem that we have to do, this technology is great and it's really going to help things, but the biggest problem is this whole political sense that we want to plan in 6 months. And we see so many RFPs come out now, like what Barbara said, mm-hmm. where they budget three meetings and, you know, you have 6 weeks to engage the public. And that is rampant in this country. And we have to figure out somehow how to get our elected officials and the decision makers used to the idea that it's probably going to take you a year. You know, Barbara said that nobody changes their mind in the first meeting. And Rob said that the worst thing you can do is pose a question, get some feedback, and ignore it. And so what begins to happen is you have that first meeting, and if you're responsive and you start to do something, then those folks will, via Twitter or cell phone or whatever they'll do, they'll start telling their friends, hey, we ought to engage in this whole thing, because they're listening. And then they'll come back the second meeting and tell you, well, you really should get so-and-so involved from this church and so on. That takes time, and, you know, my biggest fear is, and it does cost money, but in the long run, you know, what we learned at New Jersey DOT is that it saves you tons of money from redoing the thing. You know, we used to say, You don't have time to do it right the first time, but you're going to end up redoing it five times at five times the cost.
Right.
You're sparkling.
Thank you. Hi, Lenny Schwendinger, Light Projects. And actually, I'm a lighting designer, but I'm extremely interested in community engagement. And we do public lighting in cities all over the world and for infrastructure. So the one thing I'm not hearing, and maybe I just didn't get new tools. Okay. Once we get the people there, because we're all talking about getting the people there and making decisions, I'm sort of very interested in the content of the meeting. So I'm just going to jump into that for a minute. I think that what we propose and what those proposals look like and the way that we engage people with new ideas, precedents, demonstrations, you know, for me, it's map the nighttime experience of getting from the subway to the location, to the site, to various areas in the site. What is it like after dark? You know, people wake up and they kind of go, well, well, it feels unsafe, or there are no landmarks along the way, or I can't see people's faces. I mean, I can only, that's my discipline. But to come at things in new ways, I think, will incentivize people to come and to propose ideas. I mean, what are these ideas that we're showing? You know, how exciting are they? You know, to then develop guidelines rather than, let's say, rules, principles. For us, for lighting design, for master planning with light, which hardly happens in this country at all, it's lighting principles. What can we all agree on? And this is the envelope of the design later. What are those points? Is it comfort and safety first? Is it interest? Is it being able to see that monument from far away? You know, what are our principles? You know, there's something about the content. I know this is about tools and things, and I'm online all the time, but I think it's something about the on-the-ground, what's happening in the meeting, that also has to do with who comes and why.
And isn't the meeting getting a little old? You know, here's a young person.
I'm Karen Levy. I work on a project called All Our Ideas, which is an online idea generating tool. But I wanted to piggyback on what Gary said. So it seems like one way potentially to manage expectations is to recognize that once a project is built, community engagement doesn't have to end there. And it seems like that's, I mean, that's not something we've really talked about, but that seems like one of the key places that these kinds of tools can be useful, right? So if you've successfully engaged a community, maybe one way to make them feel as though their input is worthwhile is to continue gathering and using that input even after the end of, you know, the building stage.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, hooray to that, right? I mean, you know, I think when we think about planning and the role of democracy in planning, we have to think of this as a persistent process. You know, just because eventually we're going to die and our teeth are going to fall out doesn't mean we stop brushing our teeth, right? So, again, to think about this just at the project level is radically incomplete, and actually ends up being more expensive. And now, you know, I think to the questions about cost, you know, if one can actually create a persistent and consistent culture of this kind of democratic deliberation, you know, and even though I know all the New Yorkers in the room will have a laundry list of all the problems with our community board system, when I moved from New York City to Newark and realized that if you had an issue with a planning project, you basically could show up the day that the Central Planning Board was voting, and then after that, maybe the day that the Municipal Council was voting, it made me really realize the amazing achievement that the community board system is here, and that wherever you live, you can go to some place once a month and see the dog and pony show from the different agencies that are looking to do things that affect your neighborhood.
But in most of those, and I live here too, there are things going on, not about a project, but about what we want the neighborhood to be, about, you know, this, that, and another thing. The project hasn't started yet. But information is still being shared, and I think that's what you're talking about.
I'm Charles McKinney. I'm the principal urban designer at New York City Parks Department. I have some experience with community meetings. And, you know, why do we have the meetings? Well, is it just to get the project approved? It's so rich. It's more than that. I need their engagement after the project is built. I need their help to build it. I want them to help build the project. Now, But along the way, you have to make decisions, and you can't get a consensus. Because if people are voting, they're voting based on what they think is important without having a shared value system. So here's my pointers for a successful public outcome. I do want to know what they know about the site. As a designer, I need to know where the dragonflies breed. I don't want to find out about it after I've, gone through my planning process. So if they have intimate knowledge, I want to know what it is. I want to know what their concerns are. I don't want to know that I want a dog run, I want a skate park. I want to know, I want a place for my children to play. I want a place for my, to be able to play sports. So I want to know what their concerns are. I want then for us all to agree on what our explicit goals of the project are. We value nature. We really need places for active recreation. I want it to be adequately maintained. And then we're going to develop some, that's a short list, I promise you. I want to know what their criteria is for evaluation. I want maybe 5 criteria for evaluation. And I want to be able to rate those 1 to 5. And then I want everybody to participate in that evaluation using that common criteria. As opposed to us all having a big discussion and figuring out who we have to please and who the strongest voice in the room is. I just want to have that score sheet come up. I want everybody to rate those 5 criteria from 1 to 5. And then we're going to see how alternatives. So maybe we'll look at 3 alternatives and we'll evaluate each of those 3 alternatives. So it's a bunch of people with a bunch of score sheets and they turn them in and we'll look. I suppose you could do that electronically, and that's one reason I'm here. But the thing is that it makes your criteria explicit.
I think those are really, and actually I think what you had to say just overlapped with what you were saying about sort of deciding on principles and experience as opposed to trying to coming up with a set of performance criteria that people can check in over time, and especially in the world of park planning and public space planning, where it's impossible. It's not like doing an architectural building necessarily, although it has many of those elements, where there's a sort of really detailed program, and even those change. We know that public spaces change in terms of how they're used and over time, and especially as the sort of ethnic makeup of the city changes and so on. So I think the idea of establishing a set of principles and criteria by which people are going to evaluate the performance of these places is critical. Now, it seems to me that one of the ways in which in several cities GIS and some cell phone technology is being used is, and it's a sort of obvious thing in some ways, is allowing people to police their own, provide input about what's going on in their own neighborhoods. There have been several interesting initiatives around people identifying places that were foreclosed, for example, in this last crisis, and being able to map those and then use that for advocacy purposes. It seems to me that one obvious application of the media here is that you could set up some protocol whereby the people who are using this park over time, way beyond the duration of your involvement, have some way of evaluating it and reporting on whether or not it's actually the goals and criteria being met. In some ways, the Strap Hangers campaign does that here in terms of the way they grade the way the city is doing in terms of transportation. I think there's a great opportunity there to use new media to engage people in the ongoing discussion about whether or not the performance criteria that they established at the beginning are actually being met.
I'd just like to comment on Charles. That was a very thoughtful remark about the people actually know the site. And we were doing a master plan for a park in Chicago, and we were working for the Parks District there. And, as consultants, you come in and you're interviewing all of the people at the Parks District, and you're interviewing all the people that they give you the names to interview. And then you have the first public meeting, and the people show up, and they're very polite, and they tell you some things. And then we went to the white sheet, we're going to design this park, over a couple of hours, and we couldn't figure out why people weren't using one particular portion of the park. We kept asking the same question over and over again. No one would say anything. You finally get down with the people around the table in the paper, and they've built some trust with you by then, and they said, oh, there's a big drug problem in that location. I didn't know that at all. No one had ever mentioned that. We probably talked to 50 people. No one ever said drugs. So now when I go in and work on a park, I mean, the first thing I do is check the crime stats in the area, because I've learned that that could be a very telling issue in some of these areas. But it was the people who told us that. And we would have gone on. That was a series where we had three meetings. Luckily, we found that out in the second meeting and could move on. But it was amazing.
I live in Newark, actually, in New Jersey, and I think what a lot of residents and constituents suffer from is project fatigue. For many years, I was involved with master planning for a historic district, and actually was elated, excited in 2006 when RPA came along and held the two-day session at NJIT, which I remember seeing you at, Robert.
I hope this is going in a good direction.
It's actually,
how
it's
much time do we have? We're another 5 minutes.
Well, actually, it was a great, and it was great energy, great synergy, and it was something that was long time coming to New York. But unfortunately, and once again, what happened to that? And that was an RPA's fault. And so this is what a lot of people, my generation, especially because I'm not from Newark, I moved from Newark because I wanted to come to a city where I could make a difference and I can grow. And there are a lot of projects that are constantly happening. And you become a part of them, and you attend them, and you write, and you give your input, and then, boom, they're shelved. You don't hear anything about it. And so people have gotten to the point, and actually I'm working on a park project right now in the city of New York. So I have to be careful what I say, in a sense, because I'm coming from both sides of it. I'm coming from a constituent, and now I'm coming from the side where I am going to be engaging the public, and I'm going to be engaging them, but finding that feedback where they're going to say to me, okay, what's the deal? Are you going to put us through all of this again just to hear that this park is never really going to happen? So that's a major issue, I don't know, not only in Newark, but if in other cities people are facing, and that's it.
I usually get kind of screw faces from my colleagues when I say this, but I think in particular, you know, the context that you're talking about, sometimes vision is the problem. And by that, I mean vision when it's not tightly connected to an understanding of implementation. We all go, you know, very recently, and I think this is a problem in almost every public discussion I've ever seen of zoning, people are saying, well, when are you going to start building it? Or, oh, that's, you know, if the zoning envelope is that, then, oh, that means it's automatically a 15-story building. And actually being able to dial back and say, no, this isn't about deciding to build things. This is about making the rules for building things. So that people really understand how the decisions that are being made are going to touch the ground, and then how they themselves might need to play a critical role in that implementation. So I think going back to seeing the planning process as really just a middle part. There's a beginning part in schools and in just, you know, civic life of building capacity. Then there's the project itself and the design and the planning decisions. And then there's the stewardship. And so seeing those things as all connected when oftentimes those are being done by very different people. And so somehow bringing those ties, I think, is critical for this discussion.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I've learned over the years is who makes the final decision. And when you go as a consultant, you've got to get those folks lined up so that you say, when we finish this process, you are going to make a decision. Because I've been through too many processes where a few people on the inside can make any decision they want, or it's derailed at the last minute by something, you know, so the city council doesn't stand up or the mayor doesn't stand up. And I remember in a couple of meetings where I said, council members and mayor, I got no more numbers on my side than you got on your side, so you better make the right decision tonight. Now, this is politicizing the process in a sense, but if I hadn't done that politics, the council would, with a few people who have money, they would have gone in a very different direction than the direction that came out of the community. And the community doesn't have time to reorganize to fight that. So as bureaucrats, we have a little bit of a responsibility to make sure that decision is going to be made that comes from the process, not one that's pre-made or differently made without the process. Okay.
Hi, my name is Wiley Goodman, and I'm with Partnerships for Parks, so I'm very supportive of what Mr. McKinney already said. And I'm just curious, about incentivizing people's participations, if there's been any creative ways that people have incentivized participation to make sure that it is really well represented. I just actually was went to my first public participation meeting for the Brooklyn Greenway Initiative, and it was held at the Red Hook Rec Center, which is a low-income, diverse community, and it was a fascinating experience. I had never been to one. However, all the players, I knew about, you know, I knew half of the people there because they sat on the community boards and they were the heads of organizations, and many of the people who really live in Red Hook, and especially youth in Red Hook, of course, were not there. And I'm just curious whether there's people can kind of think outside of the box. Do you ever actually pay people, even like $5, to come to meetings? Do you ever make competitions for high school students, like submit your design by this date and win a free bike or something? You know, ways to really make sure a more diverse, and especially youth. I think the whole thing with the social media is really interesting, but especially with, you know, if, whether you're a working mom who's got two kids and you don't have time to come to a meeting at night, or, you know, you have to worry about getting food on the table. So the Brooklyn Greenway, well, that's really interesting, but it's not really my main concern right now. Or you're a teenager who's more concerned about, you know, where you're going to be dating, going on a date on Friday night. Like, it feels like there has to be sort of more creative ways to get people around.
I'd love to just jump in with a quick response to that. We made something recently for the DOT here in New York as kind of a demonstration project, and Rob actually showed a slide of it at the beginning called Fix City Bike Racks. So it's basically a way to try to get people to site bike racks in their neighborhood and tell the DOT where they should go, because the city wants to deploy a lot more bike racks, but they weren't exactly sure where they should be. So we wanted people to participate. We gave them all the tools and the rules about where you can put a bike rack and where you can't. And then we asked them, or we gave them the option to tweet or post to their Facebook page when they'd done this, which sounds kind of trivial, particularly if those of you aren't active Twitterers or Facebook users, but that's, in a way, social media is kind of like a representation of social capital. So it's one thing to maybe offer, like, to pay someone or put food at the meeting or something like that, but what we really want is for people to care about this and for people to sort of appropriate it for themselves and say, hey, I made a recommendation at this meeting. I suggested a bike rack. Here's my comment that I just made on the new parks project. This is that shows up on their Facebook page. Their friends see that. That's a way, particularly for young people who are using these technologies, it's a form of social capital, and it's a form of, like, it's an incentive to participate because you're giving them the opportunity to show that they're contributing and to show that they're actively involved.
I would just add, we've never paid people to come to a meeting. We have done competitions with school children or had school children present their ideas at the meeting. I think that's nice because then you get the parents and the children there. I have learned over the years that there's two things you provide depending on the neighborhood, and we do a lot in churches, as Ed said, because I work a lot in the South right now. Is daycare. There's some kind of care there for children, and having some type of food if it's a 6:30 meeting, so that people know that there's something there to eat, and you get the mothers that way, because then they can come, they can participate, their children aren't going to starve while they're there, and they don't have to pick up fast food on the way home. So I think those two are very important, especially in these churches and when you go to the people to have the meeting.
But the third one is making sure you get the key person from those groups to come. So if Mama Jones comes, everybody else comes.
That's true.
As, you know, Big Joe comes, all the ball players come, et cetera. And you learn who those people are pretty fast.
My name is Scott Kratz. I work at the National Building Museum in Washington, D.C., and our mission is to explore the built environment and its impact on people's lives. And my question comes to value. How do we make sure that people know that they're not just engaged with the decisions, but that these decisions matter? I mean, we all spend 23, if not 24 hours a day inside the built environment, yet most of the general public doesn't necessarily think about the built environment and its impact on their lives. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I think this ties in with the last question. And I think it's important to note that the most recent Bloomberg-led experiment to pay people to take on behaviors that other people think are good behaviors was not found to be successful. And I think that points to the fact that, you know, all of these efforts have to be much longer, mind-changing, dialogical processes. And I think that in terms of, you know, I've mentioned thinking like an organizer, one of the most basic lessons that you can learn from reading Saul Alinsky, you know, the granddaddy of American organizing, is you need to understand the self-interest of the people you're trying to organize. Mm-hmm. And that trying to appeal to what might seem like universal values and things like that is always going to fall flat. So, you know, for example, trying to get people engaged and be stakeholders in the riverfront of Newark, something that's been off people's mental maps for about 60 years, has been a really slow process of saying, well, you know, your church, you know, what would you like to do here? Your hot rod club, like, is there something that you'd like to do here? And trying to find those self-interests that could actually plug into this, make a bigger pie, I think that's how you get your constituents.
My name is Dan Wiley. I think we have three Wileys in the room now. I've never had that happen. So I work for Congresswoman Velasquez as a community coordinator. So I've been working as a community coordinator for 10 years. And she's brought $15 million to the Brooklyn Waterfront Greenway. And I've been at the three meetings because there was another one in Sunset Park 2 weeks before that and another one in downtown Brooklyn. And the one for Greenpoint is next Thursday. And I would say in Red Hook, part of the problem was they usually hold them on Thursdays, but because the community board had its transportation committee meeting on Thursday, well, let's move it to Tuesday. But they should have talked to me first because I would have told them that the Red Hook West Tenant Association, which represents the public housing, which is 75% of the population in Red Hook, meets on Tuesday. So then I would have to bring all the people from the tenant association that goes to the tenant association meeting because, you know, it's their issues, and they also have a kitchen in the apartment they have the meeting in, so everyone gets fed at the end. So, you know, in the future, we'll try to do it at a time when the community board's meeting and the tenants, you know, bring them all together. So that's like appropriate siting. But the other thing I wanted to raise is that I know in Brooklyn it's April 20th, there's a New York City charter revision hearings, and Damon talked about the potential of community boards, and we know how that potential often isn't seen because of the way the community board is composed and you know, how you get people involved and buy-in. And I think, I don't know what's going to be the real bottom line with the charter revision, but I would suggest that if we can figure a way to breathe life into community boards, actually give them some budget, and actually, besides just say you could do a 197A plan and it can rot on a shelf, but say, you know, we can give you tools. I think tools comes down to money at the end, and I think we have to invest money in communities to be able to do some of these things.
Well, time is money, and we've run out of time. Oh, we got one more. I'm sorry, Harry.
Do you think the panel, Mr. Moderator, that community participation produces better design, or would you rather just design the project yourself in your heart of hearts?
Oh, I can see this.
I'm not touching that one.
I wrote a book after this whole Boston Park thing where I got involved in 5 years of public meetings and craziness. And at the beginning, I started out to write the book. Mostly I was mad at Boston and the Big Dig, and so it was cathartic. But to say that it didn't improve design, I changed the entire premise. It helped design a lot because, as Charles said, the people knew what was going on in the area. They knew what they wanted. And in the end, it's the public who are left with what the design is. It's their It's their area, it's their process, it's their result, and that's what should be most important to them. The design was much better because of the long process.
Right. Just very quick, I think there's a real scale issue here. I think that if you want to design a signature building, then you want the great hand doing it without a lot of... I would say every building in the city has some urban design component. It's not that it isn't there, but I think... There is, as you start getting, and I think Atlantic Yards, which is sort of an example of this, I think once you're building pieces of a city, I think that that cannot be turned over to the hand of a single designer because it is literally impossible for a single designer to understand all of the complexities that go with what is a chunk of a city. So I think that there really is, I don't think city design is a design exercise in the same way
that
a signature building is.
Designing a building is, or designing even, well, so I think there's a real scale issue.
I would argue that whether you like it or not, people are going to be contributing their own designs and their own ideas. And so even if you are the great auteur and you have this great vision, your new job as an urban designer is synthesizing this stuff because it's coming.
Damon, you got something on that one?
No, I was going to say about something about me having this meeting at the Waldorf Astoria and how it relates to this topic.
but let's go back to something we said earlier. If people are being continually educated, there's nothing they can't participate in. So if they know something about what's going on in the city, they can even comment on how the sewer is going to be put in. One of the things I found out that when you're doing infrastructure projects, if people don't want to comment on the sewer, but if I'm running a small business and you're going to disrupt my street for 2 months, and don't come and tell me the day before you're going to do it. Because we could work out some alternatives. I move my business over here, or I operate out of the parking lot or something, and people don't think the participation counts when they can't be involved in the piece of the decision on which they have some control. They don't want all the control over everything, but over the piece in which they have some control. So I don't want to take any control away from your lunch. I want to thank the panel for doing a great panel.